Hey, Lynn. Hey, Israel. Welcome to Early Days.
Hi, Carr. How are you?
Hey, Carr. Happy to be on Early Days.
Awesome. So I'm so glad to have you on. You guys are doing an amazing podcast / advisory thing. And we want to have you on to talk about both of those things. So thank you so much for spending your afternoon here with me for an hour to talk about all this stuff. I'm excited to jump into everything.
Yeah, well, thanks for the invite, Carr. Thanks for having us on. I don't know, where do you want to start?
Yeah, let's just give the audience just kind of like y'all's backgrounds, and we can start with you, Lynn, and then we can go to Israel and then kind of go from there.
Sure. My background is, I guess, a journey from the dark side to the bright side. I started on Wall Street and worked in institutional money management, originally as a broker, and then institutional money management with Merrill Lynch, and then ended up just really feeling like I needed to leave that world in order to kind of become the person I should be, and didn't know what I was going to do. Ended up in Mexico and taking a break, and then started a business in marketing, and just one thing led to another. Was always super involved with technology, just loved technology and how it could transform things. I guess I'm always an early adapter. But I started a venture capital fund in 2012 to focus on early stage tech development in Mexico primarily, and then LATAM. Around the same time, I was introduced to Bitcoin, which I was really intrigued with as a technology. Didn't give it as much attention, perhaps, as I could have, should have, because I was busy building the venture firm. But always had my eye out for anything that was kind of integrated into Bitcoin. And then as time went on, due to a number of circumstances, one is that my beloved partner, Andreas, who my co-managing partner, he passed away unexpectedly in 2021. And it forced a decision of what to do with the venture fund. And so I made the kind of hard decision to wind that down. But I also at the same time was just really looking at Bitcoin in a more technical way and just seeing how it had, not only how it had performed, but just the different optionality it had from a technology standpoint. So decided to devote all my time and energy into Bitcoin. And around that same time, I met Israel, and we started talking about our mutual interests and decided to collaborate on this podcast, because we both come from this early tech stage background. We both are Bitcoiners, and I don't want to obviously Israel tell his story, but just thought we had a lot to learn. It's like, can early stage founders make money in Bitcoin if it's open source technology? What does it look like? Are we too early for Bitcoin builders? What does the landscape look like? Who's investing? So these were some of the questions that we both had that kind of drew us together to start Build with Bitcoin. So Israel, you take it from here, please. Fill in the gaps in your background.
Yeah, and we're a year and a half into that discovery, right? So I'm sure we'll get into a lot of that here with you, Carr. But yeah, I mean, as far as my background and story, so I kind of from undergrad and grad school studied economics, math, international affairs. And then during my master's, I actually tried co-founding a startup that was doing international remittances using the Bitcoin network. So we tried that with my old business partner. We tried that in 2014. So it was pretty early. I mean, it was hearing about Bitcoin, doing some research, and I'd say pretty immediately, I kind of had a bit of a jaw-dropping moment, you know, when I realized it was this open borderless network and the scarce money aspect. And so once we started playing around with it, we realized, wow, you can do things a lot more efficiently. And the current system is screwing a lot of people over. So anyways, that led to trying to do the remittance business. That ended up failing. We were a bit too early in many regards, but that was kind of the entry point into Bitcoin, fascinated with it as a technology, as an open network. And then kind of fast forwarding from there, I did a variety of things. I helped launch the 500 startups, 500 Global now they're called, operation out here in Miami, which is where I'm based. I worked at a broker dealer, a fintech, servicing Brazilian clients out of here in the US. I worked for Swift for 4 years. So through a variety of experiences, I've always been involved in the startup space, in the venture space, and got connected with Lynn. Actually, it was through hearing a podcast, someone interviewing Lynn, and she was talking about how she had done these Meet a Tech Talks in Punta Mita in Mexico, which were just some great tech events to connect founders and investors and the entrepreneurship community, and how she wanted to do that for the Bitcoin sector. I heard her Bitcoin story. We got connected, and yeah, to Lynn's point, here we are, you know, discovering all sorts of things in the Bitcoin startup industry.
Yeah, I just feel like y'all's podcast has like a treasure trove of just like founder, just, you know, entrepreneur, just VC, like whatever the ecosystem is doing right now, y'all have covered it at this point. It's pretty amazing. Is there something that you guys think that has just shocked y'all over the past year and a half doing that?
Well, I think Israel and I continually check in with each other about our learnings and what we're finding. And we're starting to publish some of our own episodes. We're going to do some at the year end, but we did a series about what we've learned from investors and what they're looking for. But we're just stricken by how different the whole entrepreneurial ecosystem is, both with founders and investors, than the traditional VC startup world that we came from. Maybe less on the startup side than the investor side, but the whole ethos of the investors is so much more aligned with the startup founders that they're supporting. And I know we sometimes hear a little pushback of that from founders who are looking to raise funds, but VCs are, you know, startups themselves, and they have to give a return to their investors, so they have certain parameters. But basically, I think it comes down to two things: time preference and aligned incentives. And so time preference, both the founders and the investors we've discovered have a much lower time preference and longer perspective of what it takes to be a successful company. Founders tend to want to retain control of their company and also have, you know, a tighter handle on managing expenses than I think traditional startups have been taught that mantra, you know, grow fast and break things. And we find that is not, I think venture capital and traditional tech is kind of broken right now, where only the ultra successful models get funded. We're seeing drop offs in funding and LATAM and in some of the other regions. And I think everything is just flowing to AI. So we just, I mean, I can't imagine that more people aren't looking at the Bitcoin space and, you know, just remaking the entire global financial system on the Bitcoin protocol and what opportunities that can lead to from an investor standpoint. But here we are. And I'm sure you share that, Carb. And Israel, I know you've got thoughts too on how we, you know, what we've learned.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely. And then I know a couple of question marks we had in the beginning was, are we even going to find that many startups? Are we going to have enough people to interview? You know, this was like a year and a half or 2 years ago that Lynn and I were, you know, starting to make a list of, you know, who we would outreach to, what would be our target list. And that was kind of a real sincere question mark we had, you know. And so one very positive surprise is that we've had no shortage of builders to have on the podcast, you know, startups doing all sorts of things. Of course, one of the things we wanted to discover and are discovering are all the different technologies that Bitcoin enables, apart from the, you know, basic wallets and exchanges, the kind of the obvious ones, which, yeah, we've been discovering a lot of that. And I think also Bitcoin as a funding mechanism for a startup's growth has been something that we've been lately digging into a lot more and wasn't necessarily expected, but is proving to be just hugely important. I mean, I think you see a pretty common thread now of founders either allocating a part of the upcoming round or they're already fundraised capital into Bitcoin, and that with a low time preference, as Lynn is saying, provides some dilution protection. It kind of gives them more runway, right, to build what they're working on. So yeah, I mean, a few learnings definitely.
Yeah, I have so many questions now. Let's start off with like the, because you did talk about the capital raising and how you think that's changing, Lynn. And I think Israel, you also touched on that slightly too. Can we talk about that? Can you explain why, is that happening on the LP side? Is that more happening on the startup side? Like, what are you seeing out there, Lynn, as far as like all of that and how things are changing for venture capital right now?
I still think that venture flowing into Bitcoin companies and Bitcoin VC funds is underfunded, but severely underfunded. I think people aren't really recognizing the opportunity this provides. And I think if you talk to a lot of the venture capital funds, probably Bitcoin angel investors are the best target LP for them right now. There's very little institutional money going into that, but possibly that will change now that we have ETFs and institutions are more, you know, becoming a lot more familiar with Bitcoin and Bitcoin treasury companies. So hopefully that'll shift. So I do think today, still, angel investors are probably the best source for an early stage funder and some VC funds that, you know, and there's a handful of them, and they do have particular directives. Like some funds will, you know, get into the mining space, others won't, others will do, you know, hardware, others won't. So and most of them were very early stage. Now you have like Ego Death and 1031 that will do later stage. And that's kind of the progression with the growth of the Bitcoin companies. But the interesting thing, and Israel mentioned this, that he and I are really digging into right now, and I think we took this from the Saylor playbook, you know, where he started really digging down into capital markets and seeing how he could kind of reimagine capital markets. And not all of these investment vehicles that he has, like preferreds and convertible preferreds, and those vehicles are new. They're actually quite old when interest rates were higher, but he's dusted those off and reimagined them on the Bitcoin Foundation and created some really incredible financial instruments for people. We're doing the same thing with founders. So instead of just taking the straight safe, you know, where you get a percentage of equity for an investment in the company, we're starting to explore how you might convert, you know, some of your fundraise into a more of a convertible or a preferred equity that has a foundation of Bitcoin, so that the investor is more or less assured that they're going to have some return on their investment, which is unusual for a startup. We've kind of been taught that, you know, 99 out of 100 startups go to zero and one will go to, you know, 1,000x. And that's just bad math. So why can't we have a greater number of successful startup founders, a greater opportunity for return for investors, and have some sort of foundation based on Bitcoin that can help, you know, smooth that flow? I think also for a long-term perspective, a founder that has Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and we've seen it happen in companies that early Bitcoin companies that accidentally had Bitcoin on their treasury that probably never need to raise again, but others that are putting a portion of their revenues, if they're earning in Bitcoin, into it, something that Grant from 1031 called Sats Flow, which I think is going to become a more important measurement or metric for companies. And with Strike opening this up to, you know, almost anybody can, or excuse me, Block opening this up to, you know, all merchants can earn in Bitcoin. You know, what a beautiful world that would be if everybody could earn some Bitcoin, put some of it into a Bitcoin treasury. But I'm rambling a little bit, but Israel, please jump in and maybe expand a little bit about what we're thinking about in terms of the startup founders. being able to use Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on the main points there, Lynn. But I mean, if you just kind of take a step back, Karen, and look at it structurally, I mean, before that optionality wasn't there, right? Before in the VC or, you know, startup founder journey, you were, I'm generalizing a bit, but, you know, you're talking about high burn rate companies and they're being funded and using a weak currency that's losing value, right? So now we're in an era, and it's not just Bitcoin, also because of, you know, AI and just how lean you can operate a company, where that burn rate is maybe not as necessarily high. And also with that mindset that Lynn referred to earlier, which of course Bitcoiners are well familiar with, low time preference, you maybe have a shorter burn rate or lower burn rate, and you have hard money that's not losing purchasing power. So it just completely changes the dynamic of how you can grow the business. Just structurally, I think it's, when you look at it that way, there's just a lot more optionality now. And so you see that with new instruments, like Lynn referred to, or maybe allocating, you know, 10 to 20% of your treasury or of a new round to Bitcoin. And, you know, perhaps 2 or 3 years down the line, you don't necessarily need to raise again. You might strategically do so, but it's different than the previous VC startup world where there's not much choice, you know, like you're expected to be raising every, you know, couple years or whatever it may be. And you're, of course, constantly being diluted and losing ownership too. So yeah, the impacts are pretty big.
So yeah, let's unpack this a little bit, because I got some questions. So this is interesting, because I think you had mentioned it to me and Marita, Lynn, like some kind of interesting concept here. So let me make sure I'm on the same page with y'all. Ideally, early stage companies in Bitcoin, you know, get like anywhere between 250 to 500K, right? So in this type of scenario, and we're just kind of speculating here, no one's actually putting numbers down or anything like that. But in this type of scenario, you could see like a seed at around a million or something, and a vast majority of that would be held in Bitcoin. So that way, in the case of a situation where we have to dissolve or something, that at least goes back to the investors. And is that what we're thinking here? And then ideally in the other side, if it goes great, then they have a Bitcoin treasury.
Yeah. I mean, it can be a little bit more complex, and it depends on the stage of the company, what they're raising what runway they're raising for, how fast will they need that cash, and do they have cash flow or sats flow in the meantime? But, you know, you could look at it as a convertible debenture, a convertible debt. So, you know, basically you'd pay interest to that investor would give you either Bitcoin or the equivalent in Bitcoin. You invested in Bitcoin and you hold that amount. You pay an interest rate, which should come from your cash flow back to the investor. At some point in the future, they can either, and there's optionality on both the founder side and the investor side with timeframes, where they could either convert that into an equity situation, in which case the Bitcoin then becomes the company's, and then they become a more traditional investor, or they could get their return back and they earned interest in the meantime. So, you know, assuming Bitcoin appreciates, you know, it would be the dollar amount that was invested, not like one Bitcoin return one Bitcoin. It would be a Bitcoin at 100,000 and then they get 100,000 back. So the Bitcoin treasury, if it appreciates, can give that founder additional runway for operating their business. Weeks like this week, you know, make me think that we need to make sure we run those models to adjust for any sort of downturn for the founder. You know, we're in like the November market correction right now, as we're talking. But, you know, it just gives a lot more optionality, because Bitcoin is an asset that's been appreciating. And if you don't need it immediately, and these are founders that should think of a maybe 2 to 3 year time frame that they can hold that asset and either generate revenues on top of it, you know, you can either lend, you know, have there are now more instruments for borrowing against your Bitcoin. So if you have a Bitcoin treasury, you might want to, you know, use a 25%, you know, value and then have some income off of your Bitcoin that can become working capital for you. So there are lots of different variations that have just never been possible before, to Israel's point, that we're now starting to explore and just run some scenarios based on, you know, where a startup is and what they're looking at. But we think it gives, you know, we want to be able to give options that really make sense to an investor, and also make sense to the founder, and hopefully give that founder the opportunity to retain more control of their company over time.
It's a fantastic answer. Israel, so tell me, like, because you guys do advisement and tell me about all that, like, explain how that works. And
So Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, which is a group of Bitcoiners. And Lynn and I, who offer these advisory services, Lynn and I are focused on the VC and startup side, since that's, you know, kind of who we are and what we do. It's really more so to help on the investor side, to help investors who are looking. And that could be someone who's well-versed in Bitcoin already, looking to invest in, you know, or gain access to some deal flow in the Bitcoin startup industry. Or maybe someone who's, you know, newer to Bitcoin and is still looking to get their feet wet on the innovation side. So on the investors, you know, and we help guide anyone interested into what the opportunities are within the Bitcoin VC and startup world. And then for startups, we have been advising a couple companies already on the growth, on their growth and fundraising needs. And it really depends case by case. But yeah, that's high level what we're you know, starting to work more on. And of course, to Lynn's point, there's a lot of new fundraising mechanisms that can be explored.
Yeah, so I'd be curious to find out, like, when we will see that first, you know, kind of worked out. Like, that would be really fascinating.
So these aren't just conceptual, by the way, Kar. Yeah, to your point, I mean, there are a few of the cases that, you know, Lynn and I just described. There's already some startups, which I of course won't name them, but that have implemented a variety of these. And I would say the most common one we've seen is just allocating a portion of treasury, being smart with allocating to an appreciating currency, whether that's 20% of the company's cash or whatever it may be. In some cases, it's more aggressive, or it depends on the startup's needs. But I would say, I mean, I don't know if you agree, Lynn, but I would say the majority of the startups we've been talking to and meeting have allocated some portion of their fundraise or cash reserves to Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we even talked with one VC that says that they're being repaid by an investment they have in Bitcoin and through Sats Flow. So it's like, and I, you know, this is where, you know, we kind of talk about and dream about a model where, you know, eventually, and this is far, probably not, hopefully not too far in the future, but, you know, VC investment will look completely different on a Bitcoin standard, where you'll be able to repay your investors, your LPs in Bitcoin, or have some sort of dividend. Like, back in the day, utility companies used to be one of the preferred investments, and this is back in the 70s and whatever, when interest rates were very high, because they threw off a lot of revenue. And I think this is kind of what Sailor's kind of going to with some of the variations of the strategy playbook. But if you can give your investor return and kind of a base capital, then why not? And so if a VC investment can support a startup and they can return income, I mean, because a lot of people are looking for income, some are looking for growth, but just depending on how you structure it, that the Bitcoin playbook just gives you a lot more optionality, assuming the Bitcoin continues to appreciate, which I know we all believe on here. But, you know, if you're a company that earns, that your revenue stream is partially in Bitcoin, then you've got a tremendous advantage. And we're even thinking, like, we just recently gave a workshop in Mexico City for Mexico Tech Week that was called Bitcoin Treasury Startup, you know, Strategies for Startups. And we had 150 people registered, which was capacity, and another 80 on a wait list. And so, you know, it was really interesting. And we had, I had a VC fund that I know approached me, though it's very active in LATAM, said, you know, we're really interested in learning how to do this more, because it's a tough scenario to raise funds in LATAM, especially for early stage companies. And there's kind of a break between seed and series A that's a hurdle that, you know, people are looking like, how can I creatively make it through this hurdle? And so I think, you know, these sorts of new ways of thinking will be great for just, you know, extending runways for startups.
It's fascinating. So fascinating. I love the work that you guys are doing. Yeah, I remember you mentioning it. And I remember thinking, like, and I thought about it later that night. I was like, how would that look like? But the way you explained it right now makes a ton of sense. I think the only thing, and I would love to ask you this question. So the only thing I would want to know, because I worked with a lot of founders in early stage companies. So I would be curious, like, do you think that would be a hindrance at some point if it's like an early stage company? Maybe they aren't hitting milestones or something, and then now they kind of take the foot off the pedal, that you would say. So I would be more curious how that kind of plays out. And what do you think, based off of people that you've talked to, Lynn, do you think that'll be a hurdle they'll have to figure out too as well?
It's always tricky with startup founders. And I think knowing the founder, I know you could probably agree with this, and Israel also with the work he did at 500 Global, but founders are probably the key to the equation. And so for me, I will invest in a founder more than the idea any day of the week. And you kind of get that idea, you know, are they the type of person that will take the foot off the gas? And this is where I think the tokenization, you know, problem with venture funding, you know, kind of really did a disservice to the industry. I mean, founders are raising so much money on a token that they had no incentive to build their company. You know, they were exiting out, you know, or had at least the cash in the bank to exit out. So they were, you know, incentivized not to build the company and just to take the, just to exit out of it. So that was a model that was deeply flawed. But I think with, I don't know, the founders that we found in the Bitcoin space, to Israel's point earlier, just who we've talked to and who we've met, we just find a level of integrity that's just incredible and passion for what they're doing. But having said that, you still will have a percentage that will fail. I don't know that they'll fail because they're not working hard enough, because they feel they have this cushion. I just don't see that generally with a founder mentality. You have a dream, you have a vision, and you're building something that you really believe in. And even more so in the Bitcoin space, because I think Bitcoin founders really believe to their core that they're contributing to something much bigger than themselves or their company, but to a remaking of the global financial system.
Yeah. I don't see it necessarily slowing down innovation. If anything, you know, it'll be interesting because the bar is actually pretty high, right? I mean, you know, if you're looking at Bitcoin as the opportunity cost, and, you know, call whatever that may be, 20%, 25%, 30%. I mean, you got to kind of create value on top of that, right? You got to kind of, of course, in the short term, yeah, you know, you might get some people who try to get away with, you know, raising money and not doing much. But I think those bad business models and founders will just get weeded out of the equation as time goes by. And really, if you are going to be successful at growing a business and raising venture capital to grow that business, you're going to have to be very productive and be providing quite a bit of value. I don't see the innovation slowing down or it being a hindrance. I mean, in the short term, you know, yeah, there may be some bad actors and that will just get kind of flushed away. But I mean, I think actually the founder mentality that Lynn mentioned earlier is very strong and real. These are people that are starting to want to build businesses that provide value over a multi-decade time frame. And yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to see.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating concept. Yeah, and I think you're right, Lynn. I think it really does depend on the founder. But Really interesting. I'm glad that we spent some time talking about that, because I've never, is anybody else doing that? Like, is anybody else talking about this? No, we are the only ones, right? Like,
we finally got a sponsor. Can you believe it? Vintech. They're a legal firm out of Dallas, Texas, who Club Lab uses. We actually use Jim, who is this amazing gentleman, Central Texas lawyer, straight shooter. And he does legal expertise, and he has this amazing thing called Vintech. It's a place where you can get access to legal forms. You don't have to use ChatGPT to spin up some kind of gibberish. You can actually get these legal forms that are there already pre-built. You get access to his consulting 2 times a month. There's 25% off all his legal work that he applies to the network of attorneys that he knows. There's no long-term commitment. It's all for $199 a month. He also has this other thing called Vintech Plus, which is 3 hours of additional services per month, which is contract review, drafting, LLC, corporate formation, all that kind of stuff. That's for $999 a month. And it's affordable business legal stuff for startups, founders like yourself. Use the code PLEBLAB at myvintech.com and get 10% off your subscription. And a big thanks to Jim and the Vintech team for backing the builder community and helping us push things forward. All right, let's get back to the show.
We're the only ones.
Take the bow right now.
Well, we're really early, and we do spend a lot of time, you know, again, the Saylor playbook. You know, he talked about how he really just dug deep into ChatGPT. We don't use ChatGPT, but, you know, it's like, digging into AI models to say, how would this look, and modeling this? And I mean, we're just having so much fun with it. And kind of getting back to it, it's like, you know, our advisory services, how we came about it is, you know, I guess Israel and I were exploring the space, and I guess we came at it maybe differently. You know, I mean, our core business was just curiosity of what this investment space looks like. And as we've gotten to build relationships, especially with the investors on the other side, you know, we love all of the different investors and their different visions and how they're supporting it. And so, you know, where possibly at one point we may have thought about, you know, doing a fund, I think now we just really like supporting all of the funds and maybe being a matchmaker between funds and startups. And our advisory services kind of grew organically. And so rather than really focusing on monetizing a podcast from a standpoint of advertising or revenues or things like that, it's like we would rather just support startups and see how we can add value and provide advisory services for either how is your pitch correct? I mean, it could be as simple as that. Like, do you have the right story that you're telling that will attract an investor? Because, Carr, I'm sure you see this, especially for the more technical founders. It's a difference to tell a story to an investor to get them excited about your vision. And there's kind of a methodology to it. So, you know, how can we help them tell the story? Or how might you structure a fundraise to have this optionality that you retain more control and you give, you know, a more foundational return of investment to investors? And that might make it easier to raise funds if you, you know, if you implement one of these kind of new vehicles or ways of approaching it that Israel and I are exploring and that we've seen implemented at other companies. So we're and then, you know, matchmaking and also advising, you know, investors, like if I'm looking at the space, where do I start or who do I go or what looks interesting right now? So that's where we've just this just kind of evolved. But we really we love that piece of it. And we think that we're in a unique position because we're really the only, I think, the only, you know, podcast or vehicle that's kind of exploring both of the aspects of that.
Yeah, Israel, do you have anything to add? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it just, if anything, I just compliment that by saying it really helps that both Lynn and I's background are in the, you know, startup. I mean, we've both had experience as, you know, founder in the VC side. So it's kind of, it's who we kind of naturally already were and where our interests lie and experience lies. So we're just kind of, you know, plugging that all into the Bitcoin space, and it's super exciting. I mean, yeah, we're the only ones covering this specific niche for now in the podcast world. I'm sure that will change, but yeah, we are we are learning quite a bit. And I mean, it's early, but it is growing at a very steady and real pace. I mean, you'd be surprised with how successful and profitable some of these startups are proving to be, especially for early stage tech. I mean,
yeah, let's talk about that. We don't have to share any names or anything, but yeah, let's talk about like some of the B2B stuff that's going on behind the scenes, where a lot of this stuff is, I think, is really hitting people first before even B2C, but we'd love to hear y'all's thoughts on it.
On what aspect?
Just as far as like revenue that's flowing in, you know, to some of these Bitcoin businesses.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare it to the prior VC or startup standard, let's say, I mean, it's very rare that you get a company going into even Series A with any, you know, any profitability. It's just, you know, it was kind of pushed later in the journey, profitability. And that again goes back to incentives and, you know, how this was all structured to begin with. But the incentives in the, you know, let's say fiat VC world were always just grow, you know, we'll worry about profitability later. We just need to show growth numbers. And with a lot of these Bitcoin startups, I mean, you're seeing some, you know, from pre-seed to seed stage forward already at profitability or very close to profitability, which is just very rare. And I think it's, you know, it's a variety of factors, but you know, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Lynn.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you look at the few companies who disclose, they're still private companies, but well, two of them are private, but like River and Strike, you know, are pretty public about, I mean, more public than a private company needs to be about their growth metrics and what they're accomplishing in terms of year over year growth and user acquisition, you know, how many users they add. Both of them have incredibly lean teams and spend very little, if anything, on advertising, and yet have incredible growth. And then Fold is another one that is a public company, and just you look at their metrics. So, you know, this just kind of creates a model of how companies are growing. But then there are other ones that are completely private that we've just seen them kind of shift as they're finding their model. I'll just call one out, Ambus, you know, who has had these tools for Lightning, and then they've now just kind of through different iterations have you know, created this product Rails, where it is providing fee revenue for contributing your Bitcoin to the Lightning network, and that creates greater liquidity for Lightning. It creates fee revenue. So it's not interest income, it's fee revenue, which as we learned is quite different and makes a difference in people wanting to do it. You still retain control of your Bitcoin, but you know, through their expertise in Lightning and Lightning channels, it's just they've been able to really find a niche that didn't exist before. And it's going to create greater liquidity in the Lightning network, which will just provide better opportunities for using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. So we're and Block was doing the same thing with the Lightning that they had and the yields. I think they announced at Bitcoin 2020 earning 12-15% on their Lightning staking. So, you know, and there's some great opportunities and companies that may kind of, you know, it's such a new space from a technology standpoint and with opportunities that we do see some of the companies like even Breeze, you know, they tried a few things and then they hit it, you know, with their APIs. And so, you know, it's exciting to see the founders that are, testing the waters and some of these technologies adjacent to and foundationally on Bitcoin, but to create brand new models and use cases based on their what they're trying.
Man, we need that newsletter from y'all at some point. You guys do like a quarterly report. I'm totally down to pay for that. Because just what you said right there, like, you know, a lot of this stuff we already know, Lynn, like we follow the space intensely and stuff. But the way you just explained it, the way Israel just explained it, like, I think that's some alpha there that could definitely be, I would subscribe to that. So something to think about.
It's definitely on our roadmap.
Yeah, we've been talking about it.
Yeah, just like a quarterly, I think would be enough. Like I always try to write a blog post or something just on the builder front and startup front, but like it's tough just to get down and write, you know, to report back basically what we're seeing in the front line. So
yeah,
good stuff. Really good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about the, LATAM real quick in Mexico. How incredible is that? Like, what is going on down there? Why is it so popping right now? Like, am I right? Or like, remember, because Lynn, you remember this, like 2-3 years ago, was it already popping like that? Or what's going on? Like, why do you think Bitcoin has just become a thing now? Like, I think it's safely to say, like, Mexico is orange at this point, right? Like, and there's builders and founders there, right? Or are we still too early on that?
It's becoming orange. I think it is. Yeah, there's been a tremendous shift in the last 3 years, because I remember meeting you. We were at the very first Yupanqui Block Party in Mexico City, and then we just reconnected a couple months ago in Merida for the latest iteration of it. I guess it's year three, the Pleb Lab Day, which was so exciting to see all your founders and everyone down there. But yeah, and I think, you know, to the point, like when we were in Merida, we were at the opening of the White Paper House. And I think part of the impetus of this are the spaces that are popping up in Mexico. There's the Casa de Satoshi in Mexico City. There's a founder space in Guadalajara that's really oriented toward a lot of bit devs and builders. The Merida space is more circular economies. Monterey is kind of connected with the university there. And so they have learnings that are trying to educate a lot of the business community. And then Jimmy's space, which is not, is being built, but in Cabo and Baja and north toward the La Paz area. But so you're seeing kind of communities pop up around the country, which, you know, I can tell you from Mexico City, it used to be the same 10 of us that would always get together. And now, you know, we'll have an event where 100 people are there. And it's really exciting to see the curiosity, the interest, and to try and create some programming that will bring a different sort of person. I think Ricardo Salinas, his vocalness too about Bitcoin, and he's often writing about it and talking about it as a way of protecting savings. And he's got a really broad reach on his Instagram and different social channels. And so, you know, he's not shy about being very wealthy and enjoying his wealth. And I think, you know, adding Bitcoin to that and just talking about, you know, how it's such an important freedom technology, and his university, which is outstanding, you know, that has quotes from The Matrix and Satoshi Nakamoto painted on the walls. I mean, you just never walk into a university and see that. So he's been, a big driver of some of the movement too. But I mean, I'm a resident of Mexico. Israel, you're from Mexico, so you talk a little bit about what you've seen in the shift.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a kind of an orange wave that's coming in Latin America. So yeah, I'm was born in Mexico City. I've been here in the U.S. for a long time now, but I also lived in Brazil for a year. And yeah, I mean, I'm quite familiar with LATAM. And I mean, you just look at Latin America, and I'm just going to highlight like two or three very big, obvious points for the region. It's a region that, even though it's very diverse and complex, I mean, we lots of times say LATAM as if it were just like this homogeneous area, right? But it's actually pretty diverse and complex. That being said, you take all of Latin America, and it's safe to say it's, as a whole, a region that's had a long history of weak currency, unfortunately governments that have failed their people time and time again, digitally savvy population, young demographics. So you have just a lot of ingredients that make it very, I want to say, like, especially the younger generations, I think very hungry for change, for participating in global commerce, for not being constantly debased and having capital controls. And I think Latin America is going to be very, very relevant in the Bitcoin industry because of that, you know, that variety of ingredients that, you know, I just kind of went through. And we are seeing some, I think, some leaders that are starting to pave the way. I mean, Bukele in El Salvador, of course, being the very obvious one. You know, Milei in Argentina, he's at least trying to reduce regulations. You know, we don't have to get into politics, but, you know, the point being, I think it's a very young, digitally savvy population, very smart, hungry for getting ahead, for being part of the digital economy, and at the same time, very sick of the failed government, the failed currency, kind of always being held back. And now you have this technology that's borderless and open, right? So it's gonna create a lot of value. And yeah, I'm pretty optimistic on Latin America. And before, it used to be a little more crypto, Web3. I think that's kind of how it started. You know, a little more of just the quick riches trading, you know, kind of false dreams, to call it that way. But now I think there is real signal with Bitcoin from Mexico down. Yeah.
The other thing I'm really shocked about too, which I noticed it this year going over there, was I feel like young people over there understand it better than young people here in America. And I don't know why that is. But I feel like Gen Z people in Latin America understand Bitcoin more than Gen Z Americans do. Is that wrong to say, or is that accurate? Do you feel like that's...
I think that's accurate and probably true for most of the global South. And that's probably just a couple of the points that I mentioned earlier, that it's just, you know, it's a region that is used, it has already seen it, whether it's firsthand or through their parents or grandparents or all of the above. You know, savings disappear because of currency devaluation, corruption, you know, lack of trust in government, weak currency. So I think in that regard, it's easy. It's an easier grasp. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you think, Lynn.
No, I totally agree. And I think it kind of parallel to that is that you look at the adoption in the African continent too. And just because of the, you know, just the barrier, I mean, it's just so hard to, you know, to transact. And so you've got this, I mean, I do feel that it's still heavily crypto, but at least there's digital. I mean, this is what attracted me to starting a venture capital fund in Mexico was, you know, when you've got half the population under 30, you know, it was at the point where, you know, forget about it. Everyone was immediately on digital, you know, or on, you know, on mobile networks instead of waiting for, because when I first moved here, you had to wait like 6 months to get a phone and, you know, and a phone, a landline. So it's just like everything was digital. Everybody has smartphones. And so just the native acceptance of that. And then when you layer on, you know, just fintech applications. And these are people who had always been excluded. You know, a large part of the population was definitely excluded from the credit markets, even credit cards or mortgages are not common, which is why the debt levels in Latin America are much lower than in the United States, which surprises people. But, you know, government debt is like, I think in Mexico is 52% to GDP versus, you know, 138% in the U.S. So, you know, debt levels on an individual basis are lower. But, you know, to be part of a system that allows you to get ahead either through having collateral or a savings that protects the, you know, your purchasing power. It's a more natural understanding. It comes inherent just because of how you've grown up versus someone in the U.S. that doesn't have that learning, doesn't have that immediate knowledge of money is being slowly eroded away.
Yeah, those are all great points, y'all. It's really fascinating to me how fast is it taken off? And then, like you said, it's really young. What's the startup ecosystem looking like these days over there in Mexico City? And then what you're seeing in Miami, Ezra, I'd be curious to know what that's like these days.
Yeah, well, maybe starting with Miami, it's growing. I definitely see a very healthy trend. Miami also kind of fell into the more Web3 crypto, you know, trend a few years back. I would say that was still very much the more prevalent ecosystem. Now it's quickly shifting to a healthier, you know, Bitcoin Signal community. And as far as, you know, Mexico, I mean, it's still early and it's lagging the U.S. as far as, you know, activity per capita, let's say. And that's kind of to be expected, though, right? I mean, U.S. has a long-standing tradition of entrepreneurship. And of course, there's a lot of capital here in the U.S. that's ready to support early stage founders. But it's certainly picking up. I mean, Mexico, we see it. I mean, since we started the podcast to now, I mean, what are your thoughts? But it's a, I would say it's a huge pickup in builder activity in Mexico, particularly, and other countries as well. I mean, we've seen there, and there's really great talent that should be highlighted as well. I mean, there's some very smart developers and engineering talent in all of Latin America. And now you can, you know, you can just plug into this permissionless network. And if you have a business model for creating value on top of this technology, it's easier than it was, you know, a few years ago to get started and create a successful company. So I think it'll continue to pick up. But yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts, Lynn?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mexico has a growing and strong startup ecosystem. It hasn't really been Bitcoin oriented until the last couple of years, I would say, with the outlying exceptions of exchanges. But this is where hopefully, you know, we would love to help be a kind of a launching pad for getting people, you know, startup developers or developers and talent to think about how to incorporate Bitcoin protocol into their technologies, because there's so much going on in fintech. And Mexico is kind of interesting because it's divided into regions. Like, I always look at Mexico City as being closer to like New York, where it's more commerce and finance. But Guadalajara has a super strong technical developer community there that has been working for years. And like, and this is because of the factories and the deep tech that has been part of the Guadalajara ecosystem since like the 60s and 70s. So robotics and AI, med tech, things like this that are now, you know, some of that talent is going into Bitcoin protocol or exploring how to incorporate it. And so we're seeing some interesting companies coming out of the Guadalajara region too that are more on the deep tech side related to Bitcoin. And it's just, it's exciting. I think, you know, like anything, you just need some role models of success and you need to see somebody do it and you need to be exposed to it. And this is where, like, Dulce from Libreria de Satoshi is doing such a fantastic job of providing developer education to the Spanish-speaking LATAM and globally, and really just has a mission to train more developers and get them more interested in pursuing careers. There's, I think, a lack of developer talent in among, you know, that Bitcoin companies are always searching for. So, you know, we need more talent.
And one thing to add too is that I think capital itself is also becoming more global, right? So you have a lot of the very sophisticated Bitcoin, you know, funds and allocators that are also looking at opportunities globally, you know, and that's of course hugely important for any early stage entrepreneur.
This is fantastic stuff. I love it. Yeah, I mean, you always hear, like, Roy from Breeze always talked about, like, the B2B is like the first main entrant for Lightning and stuff like that. And they just released their MCP stuff for the AI component they're doing. But yeah, I agree. I think we're still early. Like I was telling you before the show, we had Zach from Trammell at Bitcoin Builders Club last night, and he got me more bullish about all the companies that are going to be built here in the next 9 years, 5 to 9 years. And he had a really good thesis on it. So I think you're all right. I think there is a ton of opportunities still left to be built on Bitcoin.
I agree with Zach. And this is where, you know, I think I just want to give a plug for the VC funds. I mean, I think it's hard to pick individual companies that will be successful, but the funds that we see that are dedicated to the space are really, really strong. They're Bitcoiners who know Bitcoin. They think in Bitcoin terms. They understand what the needs are in terms of adoption or infrastructure, and they need funds too. So, like Trammell, I mean, it's like there's opportunities to, if you have an opportunity to invest in one of these funds, these are going to be, I think, the premier VC funds and investor portfolio buckets. I mean, I know EcoDeath talks about, well, a number of the funds that have been around for a while, 1031 and EcoDeath and Folgart, just the returns they're seeing on paper from their companies are really impressive and outperform many of the VC funds in the traditional tech space. So it's a great opportunity to, I think, participate in an exciting ecosystem and really get some wins along the way.
Yeah, and it does sound a bit cliche, but it is true that we are still very early, to your point, Kara. I mean, we were just, you know, before recording, we were just talking about, I was telling you guys about the Presidio event that I was at last week, and they're doing a great job with, you know, creating a hub for the Bitcoin community in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And there was, I mentioned it to you guys, I think it was around maybe 30 of us. You know, to me, it was one of those reflection points of realizing that you are still very early in this, right? Because, I mean, here you are in the, you know, mecca of entrepreneurship and tech in Silicon Valley, and you have some very smart people, investors and founders that are, you know, they're presenting their ideas, their thoughts, their vision, everything, and it's, you know, around 30 people in a place like Silicon Valley. I mean, it just goes to show you that, to your point, Carl, we still have a lot of room to grow, right? And yeah, I go ahead, Lynn.
No, Austin has more people. I've been to your startup days in Austin, Carl. You got a lot more than 30 there. So it's like the startup ecosystem in Austin and Nashville are more robust than Silicon Valley, which is great. It's awesome.
I think y'all are right. I think because you said this earlier, Israel, in the beginning of the call, you said that, you know, remittances couldn't work back then because it was just too early. And now with the Lightning Network, you know, really taking off in 21, you have all these infrastructure companies, and now we have AI, right? Like every agent gets a UTXO at this point and figure that out, right? Like it's incredibly bullish. Like it's incredibly bullish because now at this point, people are making sat flow in their sleep potentially, right? And like the possibilities are endless, and people don't even know about this stuff yet, and like a lot of it's going to get built this year and next year and the year after, and so Think about all the companies that are going to get built on top of that, and that's not, we're not even including any of the other kind of Bitcoin, you know, adjacent technologies that are coming over from all these crypto stuff. So like you just look at it just from strictly that area, it's incredibly bullish. And I'm to be honest, like I'm seeing it here just in my backyard. Like the AI guys are just like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, they know about Bitcoin, but it's introducing them to Lightning is when they really get it. They're like, whoa, wait, so we can, and then that's when you can see the kind of like what you were just talking about. You need to see the role models. Like that's where I realized is kind of the thing that will get them. It's just going to take a little bit of time until we get all the tools there.
Well, I think so much of the innovation has been, you know, creating tools that people really need, like wallets and exchanges and on and off ramps. And now lending, I think this year has been the big push for how do you access some of the appreciation you have in Bitcoin. But to your point, Carr, I mean, Israel and I talk about this a lot too, but I mean, I see two huge opportunities that have not really been touched. And one is AI agents, payments for agents and AI, the integration of AI and Bitcoin, because it just makes natural sense that AIs, as they become more independent and start, you know, executing tasks on their own or with your direction, Bitcoin's a natural currency and paying in small amounts. And that kind of ties to my other thesis of micropayments, which I don't think we've even touched on yet. It's like people haven't really started thinking about it. But I just see that a future where, I mean, Fountain is doing a little bit with the streaming of sats for listening to podcasts, but they're one of the few that has really touched on this. But I think that every Netflix, Spotify, you know, office software, you know, whether it's SaaS software, entertainment, publications, news, everything will be paid on consumption in sats because you can do it. It's like you can pay fractional pennies and not have it cost more than the actual transaction itself. It's like the payment rails for traditional finance are broken, but Bitcoin can allow you to transact in these small amounts in such a inexpensive way that it just becomes a whole new way of monetization of any kind of content creation. And that's where I think enormous opportunities exist that haven't really been explored yet.
Yeah, I mean, this specific topic is where you can just you can get lost pretty quickly on the potential, because it's just massive. You know, like what lays ahead is the most exciting part, because I mean, to your point, Carr, we're just starting to get into this infrastructure stage, and you know, to everything that Lynn was just talking to. I mean, the way I see it, the you know, past 10 years have been a little more the basic building blocks had to be built. You know, you kind of had to get through this stage of getting enough people comfortable with the technology, you know, enough regulators comfortable with the technology, some of the bridges between traditional finance and Bitcoin. You know, you needed all of these building blocks and bridges. But the infrastructure that was built, I think, up until now was mostly just these integrations with the old system, which, of course, are hugely important. But now I think we're going to quickly move into the stage where you start to see the new infrastructure, like the completely novel infrastructure of the Bitcoin network and the Bitcoin economy being used. And that's, I mean, multiples bigger and more exciting than, you know, these other bridges that we've seen, you know, the basic wallet custody exchange services. I mean, if you look at the remittance example that you mentioned, Carso, what we were trying to do back then in 2014 was facilitate remittances in a way that made it cheaper through a more efficient use of technology, in this case being Bitcoin, right? And even then, we didn't have the Lightning Network yet. So you have now a stage in development where, you know, Strike is doing this. For example, they're providing this interoperability between, you know, US dollar or other fiat rails and Bitcoin rails. And so now that's possible. But when you take it a step further, we're starting to move into the stage of adoption too, where, you know, you maybe don't even need that intermediary. I mean, you like the truly most efficient use of remittances for a currency and network like Bitcoin is just sending Bitcoin overseas. That's it. You know, both users are either one user is sending, one user is receiving Bitcoin, and you're done. You know, you didn't even need an intermediary, and you had to go through these stages, right? First you needed to integrate the fiat rails. And now we're getting into a stage where I think the adoption's only going to pick up at a faster and faster pace, and that'll just create completely new business models and, you know, all the programmability, the instant settlement, micropayments, the AI agents. I mean, you start to get into some things where, like, likely none of us know exactly what's going to be built and hugely successful.
Yeah, so. I think that's really fascinating, and I think you're right. Like, you know, just with the Lightning rails itself, I think you can even have a situation where most people won't even know they're using Bitcoin or Lightning. And by the time it hits them, it could turn into whatever thing they want, right? And whatever currency they want. So that's kind of what I see. It would be really interesting. So like you were saying, then like maybe there is this kind of sats flow that then pays out this person. And it's all a protocol or something. And then at the end, it pays out the person who created the content or whatever. And they want pesos or something. Well, there you go. It's right in your wallet. And it's kind of really fascinating that we haven't gotten there yet. But yeah, it's going to be cool. It's going to be really cool. Cool. I think that's all I got. I just want to do kind of a lightning round closer if you guys are open to it. You want to do it?
Do it.
Okay, cool. What's one Bitcoin myth you wish would die?
Lynn, do you want to take that one?
4-year cycle.
Wow. Okay.
I think we're kind of done with that. I don't know. I just heard everyone just anticipating it. And I think the anticipation just, you know, perhaps is messing around with the market a little bit. So yeah, 4-year cycle. I mean, we're now at a level where the amount of Bitcoin that's being released, you know, is that it's such a small differential that I think 4-year cycle is over. So yeah,
done. Interesting. Bye. Okay. Israel?
Yeah, that's a good one, Lynn. I would say mine maybe the no intrinsic value argument.
Okay. If you had to describe the Bitcoin founder of 2030 in one sentence, what does that person look like, or robot?
All right, you take that one first, Israel.
Ah, geez. I don't know if this is answering the question head on, but I would definitely lean towards the programmability side of things and AI agents. I mean, I think that is still the biggest part of that innovation curve is still ahead of us. I think we've only gotten a glimpse.
Lynn?
I'm going to say it's someone really creative. I mean, I think there's, Bitcoin's very technical, but I'd love to see more creative people coming into the space. And I think now with all the tools that you have to program, that a founder with creative ideas can just, you know, I mean, there's so much opportunity, I think, on surrounding Bitcoin and the remaking of the global financial system that I'd love to see. Yeah, a different type of a founder. Open it up to more opportunities.
Yeah, I love that. What's one non-Bitcoin book you think every founder should read, or every Bitcoin founder should read?
I can go first. Thinking Fast and Slow would be my top recommendation because it kind of plugs you into our own cognitive biases.
So I have this on my desk, but it's like the last question. And this was recommended by Paolo of Tether, and I read it and found it just fascinating that I'm rereading it. But, you know, I love sci-fi. It just kind of opens your mind up to what are the, you know, it's like, what's the last question that'll be asked by us since we're talking
is
about
that H.G. Wells? Is that H.G. Wells? Or I think I know.
It's McKinney.
McKinney. Is that the one where they go to space and then they like keep asking him the same question and then the guy like keeps putting it off. The robot keeps, and then finally at the end he like the world or the universe ends or something like that? Is that what?
I'm not gonna blow the ending for everybody. I think that it's a short read, it's an easy read, it's available free on PDF to download.
I wanna say I read that when I was a kid, but I don't remember. I think the ending was just like a endless loop.
And those are good questions. Yes. That's why it's the last question. Yeah.
Funny. So you got that one recommended by who?
Paolo, the CEO of Tether, talked about that book. And I said, well, I need to read that. Because I had not. And it was, it's a good read.
It's a good one.
It's a good thinking book, you know.
Totally.
I like books that just make you open your mind up to something that's less concrete and more open-ended.
Okay, so the last one is, what one metric you think most Bitcoin founders over-optimize for and something they should probably pay attention to? I can think of several, but if there's one metric.
Maybe just, I'd say striving for the perfect product before you know, trying to move on it or tested it out with customers. Founders tend to be, I think, a bit perfectionist with their product, which naturally so, I guess, to a certain point. But yeah, I think it's easy to get caught up in the trap of thinking it's not good enough yet or this iteration could still improve before testing it out in the market.
I agree. Ship it.
Ship it. Yeah, I agree. And I think a variation on that. We were talking about that. We were talking about both Ambus and Breeze, who are two super successful, you know, companies at slightly different stages, but just keep iterating on things. So I would say, yeah, don't be locked into your vision. I think Bitcoin is such a new protocol that has things that we're just not used to thinking about that it's important to be kind of open-minded about how your customers are using your product or what they're asking for. So, yeah, I think that's a variation on Israel's answer, but I hope it counts.
No, it does. I think Israel's right. Like Bezos talks about this too, right? Where they built the Fire Phone or whatever, and that probably didn't work for them, but it was able to lead them to a different thing like the Alexa or whatever. So I think you're right. I think sometimes you just got to ship things, and then you might have like the really good idea, or you feel really strongly about intuitively or whatever, and then it just doesn't work for whatever reason. But there might be some technology from that or some kind of experience you could pull from that you could pivot to. So.
And the customers always end up telling you, you know, the feedback mechanisms are there, you know, whether it's because they're not using it, then that's the, there you go, answer to your question. Or, you know, maybe you pay attention to which customers are repeat users and then you iterate on that, you know, what's the market fit there.
But, sound like a founder, Israel. Sounds like you've been through it. Cool stuff. Well, I appreciate y'all coming on the show and answering my crazy questions. I mean, I just been able to just watch y'all from afar, and it's just so cool seeing everything. And I really appreciate y'all doing all the hard work that you're doing out there for founders and builders and sharing it with the world. And I look forward to that quarterly newsletter at some point in 2026. Do you have anything last to say?
We appreciate you, Carr. I mean, talk about doing the hard work. You're the one who's really in the trenches with the founders, doing the hard work and helping them on their journey on a daily basis. We just kind of talk to them once you've gotten them up and running. So we're big fans of you, yours, and of Pleb Labs, and just really appreciate all the great work that you do.
Yeah. Thank you. Same, Carr. Thanks for having us on and all the work that you do there in Texas. I mean, I think it's proving to be a bit of a role model as an ecosystem as well for many other, you know, cities and geographies. So you guys are killing it over there. And thanks for your contributions to the ecosystem and for having us on. I really appreciate it.
Where can everybody find you guys at? If there's anybody that's listening that wants to get in contact, or I'll put all the links in the show notes, but like, where can people learn more?
Our DMs are open. Twitter X is probably the main platform where you can get in touch. Apart from that, Israel at buildwithbitcoin.xyz, Lynn at buildwithbitcoin.xyz for email, and of course, our website, buildwithbitcoin.xyz.